Our conversation with Eric Kraft continued over the course of the afternoon. Nothing could halt the sheer celerity of our young roving correspondent's questions, and nothing could stop the author's buoyance and alarm under the circumstances. This second part of our three-part literary extravaganza rattles around a number of variegated topics and ends when the conversationalists are kicked out of the establishment. There was an unspoken agreement that people are not expected together in an establishment to converse for too long on a rainy afternoon. For in New York, a table at a cafe is very often more coveted than a parking space. Talk, it seems, is hardly cheap.
I wanted to ask also about the notion of roles, particularly in the later Leroy novels.
Yep.
You have Ariane's avant-garde theater in What a Piece of Work I Am, where she signs herself to live her life before a stage. You were there before Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah.
You have the Glenn sisters and Peter acting out these French post-war cinematic parts in At Home with the Glens and libidinous scenarios. And now we see also the role of the bird boy of Babington, which we alluded to earlier, in which Peter is attempting to live up to this particular obligation, this role. But what's interesting is that along the way, Peter encounters numerous people who aren't willing to live outside of their role. And for example, the MDMC, there's kind of a halfway house between what their role really is and what their role should be, which is like you should be dutiful citizens and you should have your male swagger and it shouldn't be built upon this imaginative fancies and the like. And the sheriff who arrests Peter, he is particularly concerned with Peter stepping outside of his role as an adolescent because he's riding this bike and he lectures him for his role. So I'm curious about the status of roles and how why roles have become almost a surrogate for the alter ego as a and the secondary character scenario which we presented earlier. How these have come about. Is Peter's aging process that you described earlier a matter of determining his role and the roles of other people in his life and other people who he's setting down? That's really what where his imagination is filling a role? That's what it is? Or?
Yes. yes, and yes. Other stuff too.
Oh, sure,
here's
sure.
The other stuff. First of all, Ariane's a special case because she's recruited, you recall, to play that role.
Yeah.
And only after she's begun to play it does she realize what it might do for her, that she begins to understand herself in part by seeing what the reactions of other people are to this self she offers them. Well, that happens to all of us, except that it isn't made quite so vivid. We don't actually have people out there eating their candy and watching us for that length of time. So it's a heightened version of really what happens to all of us. And when Peter saw it happen, alerted him to this idea that happens to all of us and that it must be happening to him at the same time. In his journey, where he keeps encountering people who are very often, just as he suggested, trying to tell him how he might live his life and also how he might restrict his role to what they expect it to be. I think that the Peter recalling that now is one who very much learned the lesson that the role he was going to play was going to be Peter Leroy, someone who would be the sum of all of that and of reaction to all of that, and not any of these roles that was out there available for just the plucking. You know, would you like to play this?
Yeah.
When he, in the fourth grade, directs the annual production of King Lear, he winds up playing what role? The fool. Of course. What else could he possibly play?
And, of course, all these women competing for the...
For Cordelia.
Cordelia.
Yeah. So, you know, it is... When you look back at life, I think all of us sometimes see that there were many roles along the way that we might have played. At Peter's age that he's just reached now, I expected that I was going to be a physicist or a mathematician. It was a role that I thought was just there waiting for me.
Yeah. Really? What did you major in? What was the master's?
I started out in math and physics.
Oh, really?
At college.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And a lot of that in this, yeah.
Yes.
But going back to this question of roles, I mean, it's almost as if society, as reflected in this shadow of Americana portrayed by Peter Leroy, is almost dictating the roles that people must play, but simultaneously, Peter is eking out his own particular role in his narrative. It's almost as if his way of, I suppose, countering the roles of the real world are essentially creating a completely different world in which he determines the precise role that he plays. That there's this kind of great disparity. What of this?
Well, first of all, Peter's alternative universe at the time of flying is located at something like 1960 in our universe and in our America. And at that time, the definitions of the roles available to a boy his age were quite rigid, and the number of options was quite narrow. Things were not as fluid, certainly, as they are now. And that's one of the things when I put myself back in the time for my life that was going to have to serve as the basis for Peter's was something that I reacted against and found laughably limiting.
Yeah.
At the time, it was frustrating and annoying, but now from distance, seeing how much has happened and how many more options are open to a boy like Peter, it seemed laughable, and so it became essentially laughable. But, you know, a lot of those roles were defined not directly, but by various cultural artifacts. You mentioned the MDMC, the Muddle-Headed Dreamers Motorcycle Club, and Johnny is the leader of that. Well, Johnny, the portrait of Johnny when you first see him, is exactly Marlon Brando in the Wild Bunch. I mean, there he is. He's with the same sort of cab driver's cap and so on.
Yeah.
So I very deliberately littered the ground with these references to the kind of cultural role-defining models that existed at that time.
Yeah. So. But the MDMC is somewhat of a halfway house between the real world and the imaginary world. It's almost as if a swagger, which is a big component of this particular book, is something that is presented almost as an alternative kind of swagger. I would call it geek swagger, which has become an increasingly acceptable notion in contemporary culture.
Yes.
But it also brings to mind what you just described in your answer, and that is you're writing from your own memories filtered through Peter LeRoy, and you're writing from a time in which folkways are different, mores are different, the way that we accept things are different. So is the kind of artificial universe the way to find this halfway house similar to the MDMC in order to create a sort of true narrative? Or what's the situation here?
Well, this is a question I'm constantly asking myself. I know that there is an essential truth running through these books somewhere. If I could only find it, you know. there's a time when I thought I was really directly heading toward it, excuse me. That I knew it would be something that lay between Peter's world and my world, and that I probably had a much better chance of success at displaying it if I focused on Peter's world, because mine would be an attempt at an honest memoir. And it's impossible to write an honest memoir. It's impossible to write a true memoir. As you said, every perception is a misperception to begin with, and from there it just becomes more and more of a distortion. Can't be done. However, if you work on the reflection instead, you may be able to adequately suggest the truth of the underlying fact. But finding them is the work of the reader. And so because I'm so involved with this, I can no longer quite tell whether that truth is findable, is discoverable. I hope it is. And so one aspect of it, for example, is this limiting effect of the roles that society was forcing on people back then. And you saw it, so it was there.
Sure, but simultaneously, I might also counter-argue that because the form of these books is different from most novels, that truth and verisimilitude really shouldn't matter so much. So in the sense that you are both looking for the truth while also redefining what the truth is, and I'm wondering, this must create a dilemma for you when you're writing any of these particular books. How do you go ahead and set yourself straight? this is the real that I know, and this is the imaginary. I mean, we can go lake on with
this. This is a delicious dilemma. This is part of the pleasure of making the books, and I hope it's part of the pleasure that the reader takes from them. The way I play with verisimilitude is, I hope, a way of scattering treats for the reader. I think that it's what I call absurd verisimilitude. Let's drop back a bit. Here we are in Edgar's Cafe. Well, at the time of Poe and Melville, the word novel was not what we use it for now. A novel was a true account. A novel would be what we would call a memoir today. When Melville wrote Typee, he announced, "This is a novel. It's all true. It all happened to me." The opposing form, what we would have in opposition to memoir now as a novel, what was in opposition to a novel was a romance. And what made a romance succeed was not so much the flights of fancy in it, but what at the time people called vraisemblance, verisimilitude, essentially, achieved primarily through accumulation of minute detail. Well, that's what I do. Yes. This accumulation of minute detail. But my details, I hope, are details that lead the reader to say, but this is preposterous.
You know?
Sometimes, if it works really well, there's a time when the reader says, yeah, this is real, and then has that, couldn't possibly be. And one of the most rewarding moments was at a book club when I was talking with people about Herb and Lorna. And after the whole discussion was over and we're having coffee and pastries, a woman said, "I just have to confess something, because this is really hard for me to admit this, but until about 10 minutes into your talk, I thought this was all real. I thought this was a biography of two people." Yeah, so that was success.
Well, this distinction reminds me very much of a book I'm actually reading right now called Pandora and the Congo. And one of the things that's fascinating...
It's also, I derive it from Perry Miller's The Raven and the Whale.
Yeah.
About Melville and Poe.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that here is a completely wild tale that you couldn't possibly believe, but the guy who is writing this particular tale believes it because the sutures of the narrative line up. Is this perhaps why so concerned with the formalist structure of your various narratives, which has become more increasingly pronounced with the last several books? It's always been like that to some degree, in the sense that you always had the Peter LeRoy introduction and then the Peter LeRoy narrative. Now you have things like alternating chapters between the present and the past. You have the Scheherazade scenario in Leaving Small's Hotel and the like. Whether really it's the points that matter more to you than this notion of verisimilitude.
Two responses to that. One thing is that I often borrow formal structure from other books. As you said, 1001 Nights. That's very, very deliberate. There are times when I just can't resist the lure of letting another book inform the book that I'm working on. It could be theme, it could be structure, it could be both, that's a great pleasure. It allows me to think that my books are being added to the grand conversation, the conversation that's carried on from books to book over time and space. That's a thrill for me, and I admit it. Sometimes I do it just to please myself. I forgot the other half of the question.
Well, the other question is points in the narrative versus verisimilitude?
Oh, yes, right, yeah. I think, frankly, what happens simply is that sometimes my involvement with the story and the development of what's going to happen with the characters pushes those considerations aside. I'm just in the story for a while so much, so the points in the story do take over, perhaps.
But also, we had mentioned Raskol earlier, who's named after Raskolnikov, perhaps Dostoevsky's greatest hallucinatory prevaricator.
Yes.
Also, I wanted to ask, to what degree, I mean, are you informed by another literary work? Like, Life on the Blotomy, obviously Life on the Mississippi.
Right.
And, of course, we had mentioned Leaving Small's Hotel as well. I'm curious if it really, it's almost a trap to some degree, taking the form of some other novel, because inevitably you're going to digress, as we discussed earlier,
right,
into some other form. It's kind of similar to what I observed with Christopher Moore's latest book, which was a reworking of King Lear. You really can't work outside the formula too much, because Shakespeare created almost perfect structure. So how do you know if the structure that you're taking for a particular story or a particular book is actually going to work? Or do you know?
I don't know, actually. It takes me a very long time to find out whether it's worked. I'll just tell you quickly how I work. I don't start working from notes, only from mental notes. And I quite deliberately rely on memory, that fallible faculty, because that's what Peter is relying on. So we're together in that respect. And these books go through many, many, many drafts. They're built up small increment by small increment. And along the way, what might have been an original intention to stick to the structure of King Lear, I haven't done, well, to a degree I did, actually,
yeah,
in the in one of the novellas in Little,
yeah,
Follies, yeah, yields to other desires, other requirements of the story, to digressions and so on. So you wind up with a version of King Lear that also has backstage romance, you know, and the form of the novel is elastic enough so that you can have what seems to be an imposed form on it and yet still stretch it out in various places and let other things happen. Don Quixote, again, there's only the barest thread, really, of Don Quixote's peripatetic adventures as a knight errant running through it. Very much of what happens in Don Quixote consists of stories that other people tell. A novel that is discovered at an inn, which it's either the barber or the religious fellow from Don Quixote's hometown reads to us, you know, over the course of several chapters. So that kind of elasticity, I think, stretches any restricting allegiance I might have to another work that.
Two questions that are related to that. I'll just deal with one at a time, so that seems to work better. But you had mentioned how you don't know the narrative as you go along, and I know that the New York Times reported that when you discovered in Herb and Lorna that they were involved in the erotic jewelry business, that it was as much a shock to you as it was to Peter. How do you keep yourself constantly in surprise like this? Because you have a structure that you're playing with, or is,
right,
the structure something that you're kind of a loose guide for what you're doing, and it's the events that are the things that astonish you and that create this notion of constant invention? And is also structure something of a burden as well? Because, I mean, it can, if you adhere to structure too much, you then run the risk of losing the life of spontaneity.
Yeah. One thing that I found very useful, so I yearn to surprise myself. I want to find that my imagination can still surprise me. I wanted it early, and I still want it now. And of course, it's much more difficult to achieve now. As you said, there's that mass of inertial mass there that's very difficult to find new things. But one thing that works is not over-planning. For any of these books, there's always some little kernel of thing that I know must happen. It is the point of writing the particular book. And then often there's a structure that I'm interested in emulating. There's always a little cast of characters who are certainly going to be in the forefront of that book. Now, what's going to happen beyond that little set of things, I like not to know in advance. I like to have it come to me when I'm lying between sleep and wakefulness in the morning, say, or something like that, before I start writing. Oh, there's a little thing that really ought to happen. And so if I can leave things undefined, at least here and there, so that there are gaps for my imagination still to fill, that It's rewarding.
Well, how did you arise at the pre-dawn hours time interval to concoct these particular ideas? Is your brain just better then, or is it a scenario in which you clearly, after you and Madeline both work a long day, that you can't really work on fiction, or what's the scenario? I should ask both of you, too, because you also indicated that your routine was wake up at 9, start at 9, and 5 o'clock, you go ahead and both start martinis, at least according to the San Francisco Chronicle profile piece that I read from, I believe, 1988. Okay, so
it's
has that
still
routine,
true.
Is it still true?
It's still true. Yeah, the day still ends with a cocktail hour, which is when we began working on our own, and I was laid off from an educational publishing house where I'd been an editor, and began as a freelancer. And for a while, we ran an educational, an editorial services business. And we found that when you're running a business like that on your own, if you let it happen, there would never be an end to the day. Most people define the beginning, but not the end. And I found that it was more congenial to my way of working if we defined the end sharply and let the day begin whenever it was. So if there were really pressing deadlines, you know, I might start working at 1 o'clock in the morning, but that would be the beginning of the day, and I knew it was going to end at 5.
Starting at 1 o'clock in the morning?
That happened.
Well, when do you go to bed generally?
Under those conditions, we'd have cocktails, a quick dinner, and we could make bed by 6:30. But the one thing I did was always give myself time to work on the evolution of this work. So there was always time every morning, 7 days a week, essentially, when I would work. Yeah. And that was the only way I ever got it done. And it became a habit, and now it still is a habit.
I also want to ask if NAPS is still around, the North American Proust Society, of which you are the head. Right. And you also indicated in, I believe, the same profile that your religion is reading Proust aloud in front of friends. Is it true that Proust is an acceptable Proustism in some degree, a new kind of religion for you?
It could be. I don't know why.
Is NAPS still around?
Right. No, unfortunately. That was in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and NAPS had only 5 members, one of whom, a wonderful woman, named Jean Wilson, we can go ahead and say that, is no longer alive. The remaining 4 of us, every once in a while, when we do get together again, we'll read a couple of pages at least. But we used to do it every Sunday.
Were there really NAPS involved?
Way through. No.
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 Okay. But how many pages of Proust could you read before people became exhausted?
Well, we never let ourselves reach exhaustion. What do you think? Maybe 20 pages in the, not in the modern library edition, so that's a lot of text, actually, yeah. 20 pages.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, how long? 2.5 years, is that right?
2.5 years. Wow. I wanted to also ask about the concern for construction in the Peter LeRoy books, constructing things out of scratch in particular, you
mm-hmm.
know. I mentioned, I believe, the AeroCycle and the shortwave radio before, but there's also the construction of the lighthouse and where do you stop, the preservation of the leaky boat and inflating a dog, and arguably the construction of these alter egos and these secondary characters. Why is Peter so attracted to reinventing the wheel like this? As he points out on numerous occasions, it's more expensive often to go ahead and obtain all the parts from scratch. I mean, but this is his MO, essentially, that he cannot operate unless he reinvents the wheel. I'm curious as to why this is. Is it just the way that he operates? There's got to be something more here.
Okay. So we can remind me that I want to say 2 things about this. One is about my own boyhood projects and so on, and the other is about all of this as a metaphor for writing his memoirs. Okay. So first, I was a builder of many things. Model kits, electronics projects, and so on. You mentioned geek swagger at one point. Well, back around the late 1950s, I used to carry around in my pocket a transistor that I had cooked while I was assembling a little radio. But a transistor was something almost no one had seen at that time. Believe it or not, I thought that this was a way for me to look cool. That if I reached into my pocket for some coins to buy lunch, at the in the school lunch line and pulled out a transistor, someone might look over and say, wow, what's that?
But see, you could do that today. You could actually feasibly do that today, and someone would be impressed.
Yeah. It didn't work back then. No, not at all. We were always building things. The kids on my block and I built an entire system of underground tunnels and rooms under the backyard of the suburban area where we live.
Similar to the underground radio network.
Quite similar to the underground. Yes, exactly where the radio is.
Yeah.
It even included the hinged stump that you could use to get down in it. So there were all of those building projects. And a lot of the inspiration did come from my grandparents, as Peter's came from his grandparents. My grandfather and his father built their house in Babylon, New York, including a stone chimney on the south shore of Long Island where there are no stones. They had a Model T, and they used to go to the North Shore and bring home about 4 stones at a time to build a chimney that rose several stories. So all of that was part of my growing up, and these are things that I'm commemorating in these books. But the other thing is that every time I work on one of these or give it to Peter and have him work on it, immediately I see the relevance as a metaphor for the making of his memoirs, especially in the way they rarely work as they're meant to, which is the way that the memories never fit into the story that you'd like to have them fit. So neatly, you always got to grind some off here and adjust something there, and also in the way that he is continually doing what he calls harvesting the junkyard of his past to make these things. Majestic salving and wreckage in flying is where he and Rascal go to get the parts that they need, at least some of the parts that they need for the aerocycle, and Peter talks about the way he harvests the majestic salvage and wrecking of his past for his memoirs.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I wanted to go back to the formalist nature of these books and how it has evolved. I had alluded to it earlier. These books began, of course, with Peter LeRoy offering an introduction to some past episode. And now, as we have moved more to the present, it's more of an alternating chapter scenario. Simultaneously, Peter and Albertine have moved from being hotel proprietors to, in the flying trilogy, they've become hotel occupants.
Right.
What of this particular shifting? Is this a way for you to, get away from the fear of repetition? Or how did this happen?
Well, there wasn't much else I could do, actually. After they'd left Small's Hotel, they had to go somewhere. And I really did toy with the idea of having them stay on Small's Island. Remember, the option is offered to them that they might become actors, in effect, that they might play the part of the hotel proprietors, but they would never have to worry about the bills or the leaking roof again, because it would just become part of a game that people would pay money to participate in. But I realized that was going to be a dead end for them. They were never going to have the passion in that. Couldn't possibly, that they'd had in the hotel itself. And so they became wanderers of a sort. Since that time, they've lived in Manhattan, they've been on the road, and I'll tell you actually that currently they're back in Babington and trying it. They're renting a small house near the train station so that they can get into the city easily. Whether it will stay that way, this is in a book set in the present that I'm working on at the same time as Albertine appears, called Peerless Service. About it.
You indicated, I believe, in a Publishers Weekly interview that you had 20 titles for future books. Is this still the case? I mean, aside from this particular title, are there any other titles that you have lined up?
Yes. Yes.
Can you reveal one or two?
Yeah, actually, I even wrote down for it, just so I'd be sure to recall what I wanted to tell you. Albertine Appears, which is the story about Peter's meeting Albertine. Peerless Service and Repair, which is set in the present. This is Peter and Albertine back in Babington and seeing what it's like today. And it's another story of a failure. It's about a business. It's Peerless Television Service and Repair, which is failing.
Another failed entrepreneurship, which you also deal with quite frequently. Yeah.
Yes. How to Do It, which is a book by B.W. Beath. And I've been publishing that. I've been publishing segments of that as limited edition paperbacks. And the whole thing will be completed in another couple of months or so. Making Myself and Dinner. This is Ariane Ladkochnikov's book. It's conversations with her mother in her mother's kitchen when she was a teenager. And it's about the making of clam chowder, another metaphor for the work, and the advice that her mother gave her as a girl. Mark Dorsett's topical autobiography, finally, he's gotten to work on this. It's been all the years that I've been working on this, Mark has been saying that he was someday going to write this thing, and now he's finally begun. It's a encyclopedic in form. There's the formal element again, and it treats the significant events of his life. And risking the ridiculous, which I described for you earlier. Now, the overall form of the entire work, back in 1976, I wrote a youthful manifesto for this whole thing called Large and Unsolicited Fiction. And in here, this is by the Center for the Study of Fictional Behavior. And in here, you'll see this treatment of the way that a very large fiction can be constructed from very small fictions as modules that then gain, that join together through a system of implanted illusions to create a fiction that sustains itself. And that's what I've been trying to do the whole time.
Wow. I actually want to ask you, because I know that the backlist for Leroy, thank you, the backlist for Leroy has gone out of print, or you've obtained the rights again for that, and you're now publishing them through the Babington Press, the Lulu Scenario. And I'm curious as to why that is, and I'm also curious as to what effect Random House's purchase of Crown had upon the Leroy books. I mean, this pretty much kind of changed the way that they were published. And also, I know at one point you had a CD-ROM that was regrettably Mac only. I'm a PC guy. Damn you! But it had all of the Peter Leroy books on a CD-ROM. And I'm curious how these developments have affected your ability to keep pumping out these books, because it seems to me that someone who wants to plunge into this universe would want to access all of the backlist.
Yes.
And so now that it's available, but it's not available like in stores and the like, and constantly you're it seems to me that you've been fighting various uphill battles to keep the work in print. So what of this?
Yeah, they are uphill battles, right. Well, the reason I've brought the books back into print myself is obviously because I feel that the work is a unity, and that if parts of it are not available, then you can't ever experience it in its totality as I wish people would. So there's that. Even though I really do try to make each volume self-contained so that it can be read and enjoyed for itself, each one would be enriched by reading all the others. And I hope that really does work. When they went out of print, I felt I had no choice but to get them back into print whatever way I could. And this was the quickest and easiest way to do it. And so they're nearly all there. At least they're available that way through print on demand. The CD-ROM, and actually it was on floppy disks originally, it was something that I had thought of for quite some time. And Bob Stein, whom you listened to, I know, at the Tools of Change recently, was at that time had Voyager, which was, I'm not sure if it was part of Criterion or
no,
whether Criterion
entity,
was part
actually.
Of Voyager.
Yeah,
exactly. And developed a toolkit for making interactive books based on Apple's HyperCard program. So I leapt into that. Here was the opportunity not only to get all the books together, at that time there were only four, but I could bring them all together and make all the cross references into hyperlinks. Yeah. So those implanted illusions that I talked about could be made clickable. Yeah. And that's exactly what we did. We layered Mark Dorsett on as a commentator on it, but he was really, he did make some significant comments, but more than anything else, he was a conduit from one book to another so that you could see this cross-fertilization. I would love to use the new tool that Bob Stein and his people have developed called Sophie, which is allows you to bring in many other media and so on. I just don't have the time to give to that, but it would be the same sort of thing where all the interactions among these books could be made hypertextual, but in this case, even beyond simple hypertext, and hypermedia is more what it could be.
But I should point out that in 1997, you wrote an article for Reading Teacher complaining about how Broderbund's living book CD-ROMs are being used to spread what you termed vidiocy. You complained about the interactive components of animation and hyperlinks, and now here we are, 12 years later, and Now you are championing these hyperlinks, and one might likewise argue that in some cases, the annotation and the websites are sometimes considered more important than the books. How do you view the future of the book? Do you think that in 12 years we've finally come around away from vidiocy?
Yeah.
And what of issuing the Leroy books as ebooks? Are there any particular plans to do that? I'm also curious about the Kindle Tube, which got into trouble recently with the Authors Guild because it dared to read the books aloud. And this was a virtue that you likewise, incidentally, championed in that 1997 article. So What of this?
Right. Well, in that article, I was more concerned about what kind of reader would be created, what kind of reader a young person would become if that was the way a person was going to be reading all the time. And I think I was largely wrong about many of the influences that I thought were going to be negative. I just was not very good at predicting what the outcomes would be. So most of that was wrong. As far as ebooks, from the time that people began to try to put books onto something as simple as a Palm, I leapt in again and I made Palm versions of my books, even though whenever I looked at the screen of a Palm, I knew I would never read a book on it because the type was so crude and so on. And I said to Matt, if there were paper resolution on a screen, that I would very much want to read a book on a screen, and I would love to go on a trip and have 100 books in my suitcase, you know.
I'm sorry.
But Kindle will take some time, as far as I'm concerned, because one thing it doesn't do well is display images along with text. Things don't seem to flow very well and so on, and you know that images are important in all of my books. The other problem for me is just doing the conversion is not something that I have time for. Do I like the idea of ebooks? Yes, I do, quite a bit. One description of potentially a future for books beside ebooks that I read recently and found seemed to make very good sense to me and sound like a way in which each would support the other was that books might become more of fine publishing, fine typography, the beauty of the object, the tactile experience of holding the book, the pleasure of turning the pages and so on, for a connoisseur audience, not merely connoisseurs of book as object, but connoisseurs of the book as a way to read a text. Whereas electronic books, in any form, whether it's a website read on a screen or a book on a Kindle or an iPhone, would become the cheapest way to disseminate a book for its content alone. And so the tactile experience of the book would be absent completely, but the content would be there and would be delivered cheaply, quickly, and perhaps beautifully as well. So, you know, I now think of the two as compatible.
Get bored when you get to 15 and now you're done. Well, oh well, no well.